believe that the best way is to begin to see what happened with your parents. That's one of the things. The other is that a lot of times when we can see that I'm not that great a, you know, daughter either. And there was there's a gal in Austin who was really abused by her father. And she says that nothing, she didn't know enough about his past, and he died. And that's kind of hard when you don't know about your past. So she said what she needed to do in her fourth step was to concentrate on what she had done as a daughter. And maybe that it wasn't as bad, but she did a lot of things to him as a retaliation for what he had done to her. So there's different, I think there's all sorts of different ways that we can address it, is that it is use the tools of the program. Take a look at what I've done and take a look at what has happened to our parents. And then try to do, like Bob said, I love that, I love that defense attorney and the defendant. And that is, go on to the other side. And when they, and when his sponsee asked his dad, how did you live with that? And he said, I just drank and drank and drank because I couldn't stand who I was. And I can understand that, because whoever is writing this letter, I'm the one who's the abuser. And I know what it felt like. I hated myself with every fiber of my being because of what I had done to my sons.
One more thing to ask
you. Okay, thanks.
I've observed something. When your parent is an alcoholic and you get sober and you start doing the steps, it's funny how we'll forgive them easier if we can see their alcoholism. Mm-hmm. What if they have another mental illness that's not alcoholism? But is it any different, really? They're just as powerless over their behavior as we were. Maybe they got a mental illness because they were abused as a child, and they got their rageaholics. Or I think there's something that's true. I think I may cover it up with defense mechanisms, with bravado, with a lot of stuff. But when I do something that's abusive or hurtful to someone else, I feel the same way about me that I suspect you do. I don't think there's any free lunch. I don't think you can escape that. You can stuff it. You can put on a facade. But in the wee hours of the morning, you always know what you are. And that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed something in California, the Pacific group, they're real big. They get over stuff a lot with step nine somehow. They do this magic. It's an amazing thing through strong sponsorship. Jim and I were just talking about this. I've seen people, the same thing that we get out of This Was Our Course in the book, The Change in Perception, the fourth step, a lot of times guys will get by because their sponsor will tell them that they have to and insist that they start taking loving, kind actions to people that they resent and that have hurt them. And what I've seen happen on many occasions, if you do that for a while, all of a sudden your perception of that person changes, and they change right because they're changing too. Because now there's a spiritual principle that it's really hard to continue to be at odds with someone who's consistently loving and on your side. I'll tell you a little story. This ties right into that. There was a gal in my home group named Chelsea, and she gave me permission to tell this story. And I watched her get sober, and I was her sponsor's, not sponsor, but one of her sponsor's spiritual advisors, I suppose. And she got sober, right before she got sober, about 2 years before she got sober, she fell in love with this black guy, and he was a good guy, and they got married. They had two little babies, two just tiny little babies, mulatto babies, when she got sober. Now, the problem is when she married that guy, her father was an over-the-top bigot. I mean, like almost like a Ku Klux Klan kind of guy. and he just reamed her, just called her every nasty thing that you could possibly imagine. He was brutal with her, rejected her, would have nothing to do with her or those kids, called them names. It was really awful. And she got sober, and she had this tremendous resentment. But her sponsor didn't believe what it said in the book, when we disregard the other person involved entirely. And her sponsor pushed her to start calling her dad. And her dad would cuss her out and hang up on her, sending letters and cards and pictures of the kids' birthday presents, Christmas presents, Father's Day presents. She never got a response, and she'd get hung up on, and did that in the face of adamant, hostile rejection month after month after month after year after year. And at over 4 years of doing this, she comes to my home group one night, and she's got a letter from her father, and most of us there had been through this with her. And she starts reading this letter, and it just, everybody's crying, because mm-hmm. in the letter, her father says that he realizes now what he had done. And he tells her how sorry he is. And he talked a little bit about his childhood and some of the prejudice he developed as a kid that he couldn't, he never could get free of. And here's what got me crying in the meeting. He said to her, he said, "I know that after all I've done, I don't have any right to have you or those kids in my life. But if you would give me a chance, I will spend the rest of my life trying to make it up to you."
Oh, wow.
And we're bawling in the meeting. There's a whole bunch of us, because I'm driving home that night, and we'd been through that with her. And I'm driving home that night, and I realize, my God, the power of this program. That guy's life and whole thing was changed as a result of what her actions, her spiritual actions, actually not only changed her, but changed him. And I think there's a spiritual principle that you cannot continue to resent and fight someone who just keeps being loving towards you. Mm-hmm. The problem is most alcoholics are event-oriented. We want 3 shots of vodka, and we want it right now. We want to make the amends. Where's the parade, the red carpet, and the balloons,
yeah.
Right? Right, right. And to persist for 4 years, over 4 years, taking action in the face of adversity, I tell you, I'm so proud of her. And it changed her, it changed people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Here's one. I'll start, and then Polly can talk about it. How do you surrender when you know that's what you have to do, but can't seem to do it? How do you bring it on? If there is a hell on earth, it exists in the abyss between where you're really at and where you really know you should be. Right? If there's a hell on earth, it's in that abyss between those 2 points, and where you sit there and just feel like a schmuck. I'm the product of several different schools in AA. The Big Book, Don Pritz, Joe and Charlie School, the Clancy Action School, the Tom Ivester Service School. I'm a byproduct of all those schools. And I know something. You can act your way into surrender. You can have a huge, massive upheaval also, but the spiritual experience of what James calls the educational variety comes as a result of acting like someone who's surrendered consistently and long enough, and all of a sudden what you're reaping from this lifestyle is so immense you wouldn't do anything else, right? And so if you emotionally can't surrender, join the club. Mm-hmm. You know? See, here's what I wanted in AA. I wanted that kind of surrender that was so cool that I'd feel so good and wonderful from then on. I really wouldn't even have to do anything ever again in AA. I just kind of glow in the dark. You know what I mean? I just be there. And I've had a lot of surrenders, but most of mine have been the action kind. You know, there's a line in the fear inventory that I've thought about a lot. It says, when we're afraid, and isn't it self-centered fear that would keep me from surrendering, from keeping me from getting in the wheelbarrows or carrying out the decision in step three? It says, when we're afraid, we ask God to remove the fear and turn our attention to what he would have us be. What would a guy look like that was really carrying out the decision in step three? I encourage the guys I sponsor, develop a vision of a surrendered servant. Develop a vision within you of how one of God's go-to guys would act. And then be that guy. Most of us have a vision of all kinds of crazy things, from John Wayne to, I mean, all kinds of nuts stuff. But how would a loving servant, how would a surrendered person act? And then that's the guy I need to be. Turn my attention to what he would have me be. Go ahead.
Well, I agree with you, because that's what I was going to say. You ask God, you know, to help you surrender, and then you go act as if you have. And I perfect. And you brought up the lines in the big book, so I don't have anything to add to that. Okay. If I want to think of other people... If what you think of other people is so important, how do you change how you think of them? Tell me a practical approach. Okay, one of the things that happens is we did the inventory today. Resentment is the number one offender. If I have what I think of you, if I have bad thoughts about you and I resent you, I can guarantee the person who's going to pay the highest price for that is me. Because most of the time, the person who I resent or think poorly of or am gossiping about or whatever I'm doing, unless somebody else tells, but mostly if I resent them, they don't even know it. I'm sitting here suffering, and that other person is having a fabulous day. So what I need to do is make sure that I have a cleaned up street with you. What you think of me isn't any of my business. I can't change that anyway. It's none of my business. But if I am resenting you, I could drink over that. I could absolutely drink over resenting you. So it's important that I think well of you. And I need to take actions. And if I can tell you, I've had people in AA that I really don't like a lot. And I've had to do a lot of work. Like, first of all, I took actions I didn't believe in at all. And I feel like I'm like Bob. I've had, you know, the action school as well as the book school, because I truly believe in actions. And I have had to be kind and loving to people that I couldn't stand. But what is amazing is if I continued that action just changed me before I even really knew it was changing. And I did the other things, you know, where it talks about pray for someone for a couple of weeks, and I would pray about it. I would just pray to be kind, because I didn't want to be kind. So I feel like there's pray to God about it and act as if. That's kind of my answer to that.
I think you pinned it. What is your experience with guiding sponsees in their sexual relationships, especially in the first year? Well, I can't really make much comment without the video. a little to the left. Why do I say that stuff? You know, I'm supposed to be serious here. I'll tell you, I've changed a lot. I have some heroes in AA, some people I really respect that are very cut and dry in that area. If you're like in your first year of sobriety, they tell you no sexual involvement. You can't date newcomers. Don't date other new whatever. They're very adamant about that. And if you don't do it, they fire you. Well, I've done that. I fired guys. And I've regretted it. What I was doing is I was throwing them under the bus. Because I was asking, they're already in the grip of an obsession. And sometimes, especially when you're new, it's the baby duck syndrome. You find somebody that lights you up. It's like a drink with two legs. It's as hard sometimes to get away from that as it is. That's like going into a bar and looking to practice alcoholic and say, hey, cut that out. You know, they can understand intellectually that they should, but that doesn't mean they can. And then they're out on a limb. Now they don't have anybody else to talk to, and so I don't do it. I don't ask guys to do stuff that they can't do. Now, I'll try to preempt that with suggestions. You know, why don't you just turn your meetings up, and stuff like that. But when a guy gets into a situation and I try not to, the book says we're not the arbiter of anyone's sexual conduct, and I try not to do that. But every once in a while, you see a guy, and I just think, oh, he's just going towards the cliff, you know. And a lot of times I'm wrong. A lot of times it turns out, oh, it's not like that at all. I don't know. I don't know a lot. And so what I do is when a guy gets into early in sobriety, the relationship, I think the danger is that it will divert him from his primary purpose. So I will say something to him, look, I'm not going to tell you to get out of that, but I want to see you at a lot of meetings. I want to see you working with a lot of newcomers. I want to see you got to pray every day. You got to talk to me every day. I want you to turn your volume up on your AA involvement to the point where you're going to be so busy you're not going to have a whole lot of time for this obsession anyway. And if you'll do that, then I'll work with you. Because if they do that, they may still be involved with that person, but the chances at that point of it interfering with their primary purpose, which is really to stay sober through the working of these steps and eventually help other people, it will diminish that. I made some mistakes. I told a guy a couple years ago. He was obsessed with this girl that was 2 weeks sober and she couldn't stay sober. I saw that he got her in his cross. Actually, she had him in her crosshairs, but they were circling. I saw it coming, and I said to him, "Do not get involved with that girl. She can't stay sober. Let her get 6 months, 9 months, 6 months, 3 months at least, for God's sakes." And he couldn't do it. The hook was already set. He couldn't do it. He wanted to do it. He knew he should do it, but he couldn't do it. I understand those kind of things. And I threw him under the bus. I fired him. And I really regret it. I wish I wouldn't have done it. Because I don't think I was really helping him. And they're not together, and he's out on a limb now. And he's in a lot. I was the best sponsor he'd ever had. I was really, we did a lot of good work together. So, anyway.
I concur with Bob about that. It's like, I hate to see it coming because I did it. And, you know, it's like, I was told, it was suggested to me not to get into a relationship in the first year, and I think I was sober 20 minutes. And, you know, and I just feel grateful that, you know, and my first AA sponsor was Frank Fitzpatrick, and he was very, he said, you know, you're going to probably just have to do this till you can't do it anymore. And he says, I just want you to make sure you stay close to AA. And the thing I'm so grateful for is I tried to get sober three times, and I got sober on the third try. Whatever happened to me that last time is I just found this passion. It's just absolute passion for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful for that gift of passion, that I love this program so much that I feel like that as bad as things got and as much as I hurt myself, I just wanted to be sober so bad. I just couldn't hardly stand it. And what I do is I just tell the girls I sponsor, you know, you're apt to do this, but when it all unravels, you know, I'll be here. Just don't get scared to come back to me. Just don't get afraid and not talk to anybody. That's the main thing, is just don't feel. That's why I try not to criticize somebody so bad when they're in an obsession, like Bob talks about, because then when they need help, they won't come get it because they're too afraid to. So I try to keep that door open and make sure that they know that if they come back, it's safe to come back and that they'll get the help they need.
It's funny how some of us, we get so comfortable in our sobriety, we forget where we came from. Mm-hmm. We forget when we were powerless over things. Mm-hmm. And often I really tried never to give a guy direction that he's incapable of following. I mean, I have to go back within. There's a line in working with others that has become my benchmark for working with others. And it's so powerful. We'll probably get into this tomorrow, but it says that we should put ourselves in the place of the new guy and approach them the way we would like to be approached if the tables were turned. If I'm in the grip of something's got a hold of me, and some guy says, "Don't do that anymore," you know what's going to happen? I'm going to continue to do it. I'm just not going to call him anymore because I'm going to feel guilty. I'm not going to go to the meetings he goes to if I go at all. So I don't do that.
No.
Did you have another question? Or is it, where I forget where we are.
Yeah, that was this.
We're in Park Deer Valley.
Is that where
that you're done yours?
I'm done.
I had a new one.
Okay.
Oh, this is a real controversial one. Like the other ones weren't. It is almost impossible to work with newcomers, repeaters, that insist they are depressed and doctors keep giving them meds. I find I cannot make any headway with these people because they are always somewhat out there. I actually told someone I could not work with them because it was not my experience to be on meds. She thought I was kicking her out of AA.
Oh, yeah.
Kicking her out of AA.
This is a
very tough deal. You know, I don't know what happened. You know, we in the 80s, the medical profession stopped throwing pills at us because of the big Valium fiasco. You know, they threw Valiums at us like alcoholism was a Valium deficiency, and they lied to us. And you know what they used to say? You read the old marketing brochures, the PDRs, they'll say Valium's not addictive. Mm-hmm. And they threw Valium, and then after thousands of us were dying and ending up in rehabs around the country from Valium addiction, they backed off, and they backed off for a few years. But that revenue, they couldn't stop. Now they're just throwing stuff at people, and I don't know. I know that there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous with mental illnesses that need medications. There's no doubt about that. I have a couple friends that really need medications. But I would be willing to guess that the majority of people that are put on medication probably could have do a lot better with the steps and maybe a little bit of activity and exercise or some kind of something that would vitalize them in their life. But yet, according to the 10th tradition, this is kind of an outside issue and we're not supposed to have any opinions on it. Well, it goes with a lot of other stuff we're not supposed to have opinions on but do. Well, at least we're not supposed to express them. But I'm with this person. I've sponsor guys on medication. And a few years ago, I threw my hands up and I surrendered and I realized I can't. I was sponsoring a guy who had been on antidepressants for years, And he started going nuts. And I gave him actions to take that absolutely would have worked for an alcoholic. Absolutely. And they didn't work for him. Because his problem wasn't that he needed to take other centered, service-oriented, surrendered actions. He needed his medication changed because it wasn't working anymore. And I thought, how the hell am I supposed to know that? I'm not a doctor. And I thought, man, I'm out of my depth here. I don't have, like the person whoever wrote that, I don't have any experience with that. Everybody I've ever tried, it's like the medication puts a thin veneer over their spirit. I have a hard time getting through. I don't know why. There's some great people too. I mean, I've some friends in AA there. And it's the longer they're on, and this is funny. I've observed this, and maybe you've observed it too. The longer they're on this stuff, the more depressed they look. You know, I look at some of these guys, and I've had some. I'm a depressive guy. There's been some times in my sobriety where if I were to watch people that were on antidepressants and they were really happy, I might sign up. But I look at them and I think, well, they look like I'm not doing too good, but they look like they're doing worse. I don't think I'm going to sign up for that. There's a great book out. It's called The Antidepressant Factbook, and it's written by one of the great psychiatrists of our age, a guy named Dr. Peter Bregan, who's the founder of the National Institute for Ethics in Psychiatry and Medicine. He had the chair at Harvard Medical School in psychiatry for years and several time past president of the National Psychiatric Institute, and he spent his life researching stuff like this. And it's an amazing book, and he writes it in layman's terms. And it tells you why you should take them, why you shouldn't. It makes a lot of sense. And he's really against. He's pretty adamant about some of the doctors, some general practitioners that are giving medications to people without any kind of psychiatric background check or nothing. I have a guy that I talked a little bit about him who's dead today because he started sexual behavior at 14 years sober, and it depressed him so much that a doctor in AA, it was a GP that should have known better, had some kind of crazy Al-Anon slip in a meeting, and in a meeting he heard him talk about being depressed, wrote him a prescription for this stuff, which allowed him to continue the behavior. I'll tell you, I don't know about anything except anybody except me, but I'll tell you, depression has been one of God's great tools to move me and to get off my butt.
Exactly.
My sponsor talks, and I heard Sandy Beach say the same analogy. He said, "And our lives depend upon us finding and doing God's will, being spiritually connected." And he said, doing God's will or being spiritually connected is very similar to in the old days when pilots would pilot an aircraft. They had these headphones on. And when they're landing the aircraft, they would get on what's called the beam. And they would follow this. And when they were right on the beam, all you hear in the headphones is this mellow hum. If you get too far off to the right, you hear this Morse code signal, wah, 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 wah. It's irritating. You'll just, okay, back on the thing. Get too far off the other side, it's meow, 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 meow. No, get right back on the beam. They both said the same thing. When you take medication, it's like taking the headphones off because it's irritating. It's great until you land your plane in the parking lot of the mall. Right. But how does God talk to you? Sometimes through emotional disturbances inside of me. Isn't it funny that every alcoholic I've ever known has wanted to medicate or run away from the thing that is going to move them to something better? You know? What would have happened to me if a day before I got sober, if someone would have come along and alleviated me of all the consequences I had incurred in my life at that point? Think I'd have got sober? No, why would I? I don't know. I think pain sometimes is a blessing. Now, that don't mean I'm signing up for it. And it don't mean I'm going to say that when I'm having it. But objectively, it's a blessing, really. You say anything?
Well, I'm with you. This is a tough one. And one of the things that happens is it appears that this is a broad statement, but I'm going to say it anyway. It appears that Western medicine, if they can't give it a pill or cut it out, and what happens is that people go to these doctors, because I know I have sponsored women that are on antidepressants and lots of stuff. And I have one woman that's schizophrenic, and, you know, all of it's hard. All of it's hard. And I have a really hard time with it. But I try to see that the 10th tradition says that it's an outside issue. And I know that I'm not a doctor. But one of the things that I continue to do is try to talk to them about this medication. Because I know that some people need to have that, just like what Bob was saying. And here's the problem that I get into for myself. And that is that do I think that people in Alcoholics Anonymous are taking medication who don't need it? Oh, my God. Yes, I do. I have never seen anything like it. And I want you to know, when I quit working in treatment, I worked in treatment for 15 years. And when finally insurance companies, because of, you know, getting the treatment paid for, the insurance company said, well, they have to be on this medication or they have to be on that medication, I had to get out. And then what happened is I went to work for an insurance company. And I knew. I mean, they're sitting there with these people on the other side of the phone giving directions to somebody who's got the patient in front of them. And what happens is people were so busy trying to keep the people in treatment that they would give them the medication anyway. I couldn't sign up for that. It went totally against my morals. And because I'm a gal that believes in AA. But I also know that there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous who need medication. I mean, there are people who have mental illnesses here just like anything else. And the deal is do I know the difference? And the answer is no. I don't know the difference. I'm not a doctor. I don't know the difference. And I just can't do either one. I can't say I'm not going to sponsor you. I just try to. I've got a situation right now where it just breaks my heart. And I know that I know without a doubt the person is over-medicated. I know they're over-medicated. And all I do is just keep trying to talk to them about the medication and say, you know, are you taking a look at this? Have you talked to your doctor? When I call you on the phone, you sound funny. And I'm just trying to continue to bring up the fact that there's nothing else I can get because they're too medicated. Then I've got a lady that I know she's got a lot of problems. And I called her on the phone the other day and I said, what's going on with you? You sound so funny. And she says, oh, nothing. I says, are you taking some kind of medication? And she said, oh, yeah, my doctor diagnosed me bipolar. And her mouth was just so thick, I said, you know, do you know this is how you sound? So I don't know. I'm with you. I don't know how to handle it. I don't want to, you know, as you said, kick them under the bus. I don't want to do that. I'm afraid if I'm at least not talking to them, they're not going to do anything. And I think it's a serious problem. So that's,
and you can't just quit taking that stuff
either. No.
Even if you find the desire within yourself that you're going to quit, it's dangerous.
Oh.
I watched some guys get off of Prozac after 7-8 years of Prozac use. I've seen heroin addicts have a better time. Mm. Crawling the walls, insane.
Mm. That's crazy. It's just scary. It's just too scary.
Yeah.
It's just scary. That's all. And I am not educated enough nor knowledgeable enough to. It's just scary.
If there's someone here and you have a desire to get off that stuff and you'd like to see for a trial basis if alcoholics, if you did AA exclusively and helped others and worked the steps for a year to see if that would light you up enough that you wouldn't need this stuff, you got to go to your doctor and tell him what you'd like to do and see if he'll work with you. Don't just quit it. Don't do it. And somebody in AA tells you to just quit it, don't listen to them. We're not doctors.
It's just too scary.
We have our experience, but that's all we have. We're not doctors. You have another question?
Yeah. Fears of being like my dad. This fear of being like my dad, that is an abuser of a types. What do I do? I think what this, I'm not probably reading this right, but it sounds like he has a fear of being an abuser like his dad. Do you read it like that? Fear of being like my dad. That is an abuser of a type. Of a type. What do I do? Well, I think what we've been talking about is do these steps. Keep looking at yourself. And what else can you do? One of the things I know is that be aware. I mean, I am so grateful that my sons are not abusive parents because I was an abusive parent. But I believe what has happened is that they have been willing to get help for themselves. Now, my oldest son did some therapy early on when I first got sober. My youngest son is almost 25 years sober in AA. So what happens is he's worked the program and says every day that one of his kids is just like him, so he says me back's a bitch. So, but the thing about it is because he works the program and because he has a sponsor and because he's talking to that sponsor and getting help, he has a way of dealing with his anger. And most of the time that's what, kids, that's their job is to make us angry. It's their job. It's what they're supposed to do. And if we don't have some way to deal with those emotions, then we're apt to abuse. I think the program worked the steps.
Next question. How do we learn to get along with others? When all else fails, try violence. We have a set of principles in Alcoholics Anonymous that I often think are more amazing than the steps. Uh-huh. And they're used to get along with other people. And they're the 12 traditions. I was lucky. I was encouraged by a guy when I was pretty new to start thinking about the 12 traditions as if they were positions and attitudes and stances I could take in my own life. At work, family matters, committee matters, AA matters. Anytime I'm together with other people. The steps of AA are designed to keep me from killing myself, and the traditions are designed to keep me from killing you. I mean, so we can get along. And why couldn't I get along with people? Because I'm putting me first, mm-hmm. Right? I'm running the show. And one of the great principles of Alcoholics Anonymous is in that 12th tradition. And I misinterpreted it for a long time. It talks about putting principles before personalities. And you know what I thought that meant for a long time here? I thought it meant that I needed to put the spiritual principles of Alcoholics Anonymous ahead of your screwed up, obviously, personalities. And there's only one personality that I have to apply those principles to. I have always been the seat of my judgment and conflict and separation. I have the mind of and the ego of an alcoholic that will paint pictures to me that it's you, but it's always me. I must put these principles ahead of my personality because there's only one person in this room that ever wants me separate, alone, and out of here, and it's me. I'm the one. That's the same at work. It's the same in family matters. It's the same on committees. It's the same in any endeavor I could enter into where there's people involved. I must put there's a line in our book that I've really come to think a lot of it lately. It says that we found that spiritual principles would solve, and it uses the word all our problems. Mm-hmm. All. I told that to a guy that works as a used car salesman not too long ago. He goes, oh, not in our business. I think so. I think it solves all our problems.
Well, I agree with that. In fact, I truly believe with all my heart the reason I have enjoyed the marriage I have is because Dick and Peggy down in Omaha, Nebraska, sat down one day at a conference and took Dave and I through the traditions and how to apply them to our marriage. And what I do is just pick that up and use it in all of the things that I do. And it's all about putting the, you know, it's about unity, and it's about caring about you before I care about me. All that stuff that's so hard to do. But when I practice that, I enjoy it. I enjoy being around people, because if I'm trying to see how I can help you, it's amazing how much better I feel when I'm always looking at me. Okay. The Big Book, page 64. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. How often should we take a four-step inventory? I personally don't have a time on that. I have done them. I probably in my sobriety have taken 3 formal 4 steps. But what I do is I do 10 steps a lot. Every day I do a 10 step. And what I try to do is I try to keep that wreckage cleaned up with the 10 step. I know people who do a yearly inventory. I think that's fabulous. I just personally don't do that. One of the things is that I sponsor, I have quite a few women that I sponsor. So what I encourage them to do, if they can, so maybe like I'm out of town this weekend and things like that, and I encourage, get yourself a 10-step buddy, somebody that you can talk to and get these 10 steps taken care of. And I used to have a 10-step buddy. And it was great for me, and she worked where I worked, but she was an Al-Anon. And it worked for me because I'm in both programs, so it worked fabulous for me. But what I need to do is I need to get that inventory out immediately and make amends promptly, which is right away. So, I mean, I don't have – my first thing is – we were talking about that, Sylvia and I, today. If somebody comes to me and they're talking about what's going on, and my answer is always, well, you think you might want to inventory that and give me a call back? Because I feel like I'm not, as if I'm talking about it, I do not have the same perspective, and I cannot see it the same way as if I write it down. And that's just, I need to do that. And I feel like that when I write it down, I can see more clearly when it's down on the paper than when it's in my head.
I had a business, a chain of retail stores, and we used to do regular inventory. And then periodically we would do a very serious, in-depth inventory. We do it ourselves. We wouldn't trust the inventory company, Washington Inventory. We do it ourselves. And why would we do that? Because our bottom line was getting shaky. Mm-hmm. And something, we had to do something. And so I do a regular inventory, but how do I know when it's time to go back and do a massive house cleaning? When my bottom line gets shaky.
That's a great idea. That's
what's my bottom line? To carry out the what's it look like when you get spiritually sick? I'll tell you what it looks like to me. I am fine, thank you. But boy, are there a lot of crap heads around me, man. Self-centered, selfish people. And that's a pretty good sign that something's wrong with me.
Yeah.
Should I read one?
Mm-hmm.
if a coworker is lying and deceitful and I am sarcastic, do I owe an amends and why? Oh, I could go a lot of places with that one. We owe amends when? When we've done harm.
Right.
The word sarcasm comes from a Greek word meaning to rip the flesh. If we're other-centering ourselves, have you ever been on the receiving end of sarcasm when you're vulnerable? I almost punched a guy in an AA meeting. I was having a bad day. I was sober about a year. And he came up to me and says, "How you doing?" "I'm doing all right." He says, "Tell your face." Oh, I started thinking, maybe prison wasn't so bad. That's sarcasm.
Yeah.
Rip your flesh.
Yeah.
Why would I? And I've been sarcastic in my life a lot. Why would I do that? Because I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I feel less than. It's a compensator. I'm going to take the big paramount question.
Yeah. Why is Troy so humble? Anybody want to? I have no experience. Does anybody want to tell me why Troy's so humble?
Well, let's first of all, let's see a show of hands of people who think he is so humble. He's the one that asked the question. How much did he pay you? Troy put it in the basket. No, actually, I did. last question.
Good guy.
Last question. Troy is very humble.
Yeah, he is.
Until we told him that. Not anymore now. Now we ruined it. It's done now. How do you get rid of character defects you want to be free of but can't seem to get rid of, especially if you're willing? Well, there's willing and then there's willing. I can tell you a couple ways to get. You really want to get rid of them? Every time you indulge it, you got to tell everybody in your home group.
Yep, that's a good one.
You know, Tom Ivester told. Tom is wonderful. I went through a period, and since I was new, I don't cuss in AA meetings. I don't do it. But I went through a period where I found myself cussing it just in institutions. like in jail meetings, right? And I realized what it was, and I was having a hard time. I tell myself what it is. It's fear. I'm afraid that these guys aren't going to accept me. Like I have to look harder and or whatever than I really am for their approval. That right? It's that self-centered, that awful self-centered fear.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that, and I asked. I said, "Please, God, don't only swear anymore." And I did it again. I tried again, and I did. It slipped, and it's the kind of thing. It slips out 2 seconds after I say the word. I'm thinking, "Oh man, why'd I say that? What am I doing here?" And Tom was great. You know what Tom told me to do? He said, "Stop yourself and publicly apologize every time you cuss in a meeting." I haven't cussed since. I don't think. Right? Because I don't like to apologize.
I totally agree with that. I even do that. I find myself, I've been sober a long time, but I can sit and I can start telling somebody a story, and the next thing I know, I'm embellishing that story and I'm exaggerating that story. I'm telling more, and that is just exaggeration. Is just a polite way to say I lie a lot. You know,
I thought it was creative.
So what I do is I'm just like, I have to stop right then and tell on myself. Because if I don't, I tell you, I can't afford to let myself get away with that. Because I can lie with impunity. And I have to tell on myself. I have to. That's all I got.
That's all the questions. You want to do it? We got a little bit of time. You want to do something on what time are we supposed to quit? Yeah, we got an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start step nine.
Yeah.
I don't want to start on this.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Go ahead.
Oh, wait, we got. Well, we might as well stay here because the mic's here.
Oh, okay. Oh, yay, we're just going to sit down.
Page 70. Six, the bottom of the page starts the section on step nine. I just want to touch on a couple things. Top of page 77, third line down. Our real purpose, it says, and this is talking about why are we even approaching amends? Why are we really doing everything we've done up to this point in AA? Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. It's not to be of maximum service. It's to fit ourselves. When I say in the seventh step prayer, take away the things that stand in the way of my usefulness. As I'm going out to pay people back and apologize for mistakes I've made and things I've done to hurt them, I'm doing it to fit myself to be of maximum service. We started a process that the book says we're to continue, and we started in step four, and that's to grow in understanding and effectiveness. I could tell you a dozen stories about people's lives that have been changed or even got sober as a result of a member of AA making amends to someone, and it touched them, and something happened. See, a lot of times, I'm so self-centered that I think the amends is about me. And a lot of times it's not. I'll tell you one story. There was a gal that I owed amends to that I went back to Pennsylvania and looked for her when I was about 4.5 years sober, somewhere in my first, before, I think it was before I was 5 years, and couldn't find her. She fell off the face of the earth. And I kind of gave up. And 17 years sober, I'm with my friend Billy Smith, and they needed another speaker at a conference I was going to, and I recommended Billy, so we went back, and we were in his hotel room, and it happens to be in one of the towns I used to live in, and I just on a fluke picked up the phone book, looked in the phone book, and I see her name in there. It wasn't in there before, and I called, and she answers the phone. I said, Anna, this is, she says, I thought you were dead. No, I'm not dead, I'm good. And I started the process. I owed her a bunch of money. I got to send her some money. And we started becoming friends. She calls me once in a while. And she started telling me this story that her and her fiance are really close friends to a guy I knew named Jimmy. And Jimmy owned this bar called the 724 Bar, because that was the name of the highway it was on. It was a little outside of Vegas. And that was the number one place I drank for a period of time. And basically, because of the couch I was sleeping on, it was the only bar within crawling distance to where I'm crashing, right? So I'd go, and I couldn't drive at the time. I didn't have a license. My license had been taken away. So I'd go up to this bar. Well, Anna tells me, she says, yeah, Jimmy just got out of Chit Chat Farms for the second time. That's a big rehab in Pennsylvania. Yeah, Chit Chat, right. They changed the name. It's called the Karen Foundation. And yeah, named after the founder. And she says he just got out of there again. And I said, really? I said, would you do me a favor? Would you tell him that I am sober and Alcoholics Anonymous 17 years? And she said, yeah. About a week later, early in the morning, I get this phone call. And it's this guy, Jimmy. I hadn't talked to him in years. And Jimmy says, he used to call me Red Daryl. I had red hair before Mother Nature painted it white. And he says, is this Red Daryl? I said, yeah. He says, I heard you're sober. Oh, I said, yeah, I am, Jimmy. So 17 years. He says, come on, this is Jimmy. Tell me the truth. He said, Jimmy, I'm sober. He says, yeah, come on, tell me the truth. I said, no, honest to God, Jimmy, I'm sober. He said, but you're smoking shit, right? I said, no, I'm not doing anything. You're taking pills. I said, Jimmy, honest to God, I'm not doing anything. He says, come on, you can't. He says, you were the worst drunk I ever saw. And I was bad. Jimmy used to throw me out of his bar probably 3 or 4 times a week. Not for anything. I would run out of money, and I got the phenomenon of craving, so I would drink people's drinks when they went to the bathroom, you know? pathetic stuff, right? Steal your change off the bar, and I get caught because I'm a knucklehead, right? He'd throw me out of the bar, cuss me out, don't you ever come back in there, and then I'd be sick, and I'd have a little bit of change together, and I need a drink, and I'm shaking, and I'd go up there in the morning, he's just starting to open, he'd start yelling, I'd say, Jimmy, I'm sorry. He said, all right, I'll let you back in there, but you try that crap again, I'm going to throw it. I promise you, Jimmy. Well, eventually I'd run out of money, and I'd do this. And I went over and over and over again with that stuff. And Jimmy can't. And he says, how are you sober? I can't believe you're sober. I told him, I says, I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. He went, So I've been to that AA in the treatment center. I don't self-righteous people. I don't like it. I didn't like those meetings. I said to him, Jimmy, you know, remember how in Reading, remember how all the different bars there were rock and roll bars, there were country and western bars, there were redneck bars, there were yuppie bars, there were gay bars, biker bars, motorhead bars. There was a lot of different types of bars. And if you really need a drink, any one of them would do. But you usually kind of hung out in the places that fit you. I said, AA's like that. Why don't you give it a chance? Go to a bunch of different meetings. Find your bar. Find your spot. And Jimmy joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And all of a sudden, I knew why I couldn't find Anna at 5 years sober and why I could find her at 17 years. It wasn't even about me. It was about Jimmy. Mm-hmm. Right? There's a lot of... that. Bottom of page 77... there's a paragraph that starts at the bottom of 77, ends at the top of 78, where Bill hammers home a point in amends that is just paramount. He starts off by saying, under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Under no condition. He goes on to say, on the next page, the very top of 78, never trying to tell them what they should do. And then he goes on and says it again in different words. Their faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. Now, why would Bill say the same thing in three different ways in one paragraph? Because I think he knows how we are. When you think about it, here you are. You've humbled someone who's hurt you. Maybe they owed you money. Maybe they never paid you for that half pound of pot. And you ripped them off, and now you've made amends for ripping them off. And the temptation after you've humbled yourself and paid them back the money and to just kind of straighten them out a little bit. You know, I mean, just to tell them where they were wrong. The temptation is so strong, and yet if we do that, we will undo everything we've come there to do, because we will instantly put them on the defensive. And we're coming there really to reduce the separation between me and that person so that I can be of a place where I can be of maximum service, so I can be effective, so that I can be helpful, so I can't criticize them. Down a little further on the page, it says, most alcoholics owe money. Everybody I've ever known owed money. We were sitting around one time, a bunch of us, all sober, over 20, 30 years, a bunch of us, and we were trying to figure out what the average length of time is where people finally pay their last financial amends. And we were kind of guessing it's probably somewhere about 7, 8, 9 years. Some people, 3 years. Some people, 15 years. But further on down the page, it says we must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink if we are afraid to face them. Alcoholics Anonymous, this ninth step is really where I get to alter and change my very karma. I didn't know what karma meant for a long time. I thought it was that comes around, goes around thing. Until I heard a PBS deal done by Alan Watts. And Alan Watts said something that really hit me. He said if you were to literally translate the word karma out of the Hindi into the English, it would translate out as the word doing. It's your doing. You screwed some people over here. Now your life seems to be burning to the ground over here. You're the one that's actually burning it to the ground. Mm-hmm. You may not know that. And I've seen guys sober 20 years that have had jobs where they made over $100,000 a year that are broke, and the more money they make, the deeper in debt they go. And inevitably, as we start to dig out of the mess, we always find out that there's unmade financial amends that has unconsciously rendered them into an unworthy receiver of the abundance God would gladly and freely give all his kids. It's not to make it right with God. God loves you. It's because I become an unworthy receiver. And you watch these people, they abundance comes their way, and they will find ways to systematically piss it away over and over and over again. I don't think you can hang on to something you don't secretly deserve. When I was probably 20 years sober, I found myself in a situation where I was about 18 years sober. I got a shipment of merchandise that totaled almost a little over $22,000 from out of state, and it was cleared by a local distributor in Las Vegas. And the way the three-tier system works with this kind of merchandise, because it's taxed and everything, is it has to come through a local guy. He pays the state tax, you pay him. It's like a pass it on kind of deal, right? Well, I never got an invoice. Didn't think much of it. Thought to myself, well, it'll probably be on the statement. Next beginning of the month comes, statement comes, not on the statement. I told my bookkeeper, I said, it's not on the statement. Well, this is all, it's not it, merchandise that's in their database. They're probably going to have to hand enter it. Maybe it'll be on the next statement. Watch for it. Well, the next statement came, it wasn't on there. So I told my bookkeeper, who was overly loyal to a fault, I told her, I said, Linda, I said, contact them. Tell them we need to pay this. Let's make this right. And at that point, I could have just written the check. Would have been no problem at all. She called him up because she's like an untreated. She was just a wonderful woman, but she's a little bit of an untreated Al-Anon. And here's what she says. She doesn't do what I tell her to do. She calls him up and she says, would you do a little research and look through your records and see if there's any chance that we might have an outstanding bill or owe you anything? They got back to her and they said, oh, no, we're clear. You don't owe us anything. She comes to me and says, oh, they said we don't owe. I said, Linda, we owe them. We got that stuff. He said, well, they didn't. It's not on their. I said, it doesn't matter. We got to pay them. Yeah. And here's where I made my mistake. She says to me, she said, couldn't we just wait till after the holidays? Our cash flow's better. And like a knucklehead, I said, well, yeah, maybe. Okay. Well, from the minute I took that stance, the business started to go like this. Within a year and a half, I'm afraid I'm going to lose the business. It's doing that poorly. And you know how, do you ever have those awakenings where all of a sudden you connect the dots to what's going on? You may not want to know what's going on, but all of a sudden it's like, oh, yeah, no. And I realized one day, that the reason I'm going down, that the spirit of my business is sick and I'm going down the tubes, is I never paid those people that money. And I thought, man, I better pay it or I'm. And now I had to use my line of credit. Before, I was in better shape. I could have paid it with cash. Now I got to use a line of credit. I call up the, and this is such a huge company, you can't even talk to the guy who owns it. He's got so many buffers. I finally got through all these secretaries and people. I got to his executive secretary. I get her on the line. I tell her, I said, I need to talk to Pat. She said, well, you can't talk to him. You got to tell me what it is. This is as far as you're going to get. So I told her. And she says, let me call you back. And she calls back. She says, we don't have a record of that. You don't owe us any money. I said, listen, I owe you this money. I got to pay you this money. She says, well, I don't understand. I said, listen, I owe you this money. And I owe you interest. It's been a while. And she said, this is very irregular. We don't even know what to do with this.
I'm kidding.
And I said, please, you don't understand. I have to pay you this money. I didn't say this to her, but I thought to myself, if I don't, I'm going to be homeless in about a year. Right? I got to pay you this money, man. And she talks to her boss and gets back to me. She says, okay, but you can't. He refuses to accept interest, and he's going to give it to a charity. I said, I don't care what he does with it. I just have to pay it. And in order to cover the interest, I started pushing as much of my business to them as I possibly could against their competitors to make it up. And I sent them that check, and I'll tell you, within just a couple months, somebody came along and offered to buy my business, and I was able to retire. Just like that. And I think I would have lost my business if I would have. And you think to yourself, well, again, that sounds weird. It's like voodoo or something. You know, why don't you stick a pin in your big book? But I'll tell you something. I am absolutely convinced from my experience in the realm of the spirit, there's a connection of all this stuff. It's all connected. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can escape it. Now, the argument would be was that I'm unconsciously sabotaging my business because I owed that money. But I'll tell you something, I couldn't see it. If that was the case, I don't know that I'm doing it. It looked like it was just happening to me. But how often through inventory does it look like people are doing stuff to us and we find out, nah, I made decisions based on self, which later placed me in that position to be hurt. Polly?
I wanted to just talk about this. Most alcoholics owe money. Well, I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when I got sober, and I did not owe money. And the reason being is because I was still married with a very responsible husband to money. And that's why I didn't owe money. It had nothing to do with me. But at 16 years of sobriety, my husband and I filed bankruptcy. And one of the things that I knew that is that somehow I had to pay that money back. I had to find a way. And it wasn't a huge amount. It was just more money than I had at the time. And what happened was is when we first got jobs back and we were able to start making payments on this money, a lot of the places don't want your money. I don't understand about how credit card places work. I guess they file somewhere and they don't want the money back. And so we couldn't give it to them. But I started doing other things that I could use and that I could take that money and give it to the people. And we knew exactly how much had been discharged. We had it written right down. So you know exactly how much money is owed. And what we began to do is do things to help other people, newcomers who needed a place to live. And we didn't charge anything for them to stay with us, food, board, or anything. And we started trying to help people in another way. One of the things that I began to do is take people to conferences, pay their way. We have a great, big, huge, fancy conference in Southern California that I just love called the Desert Powwow. And so what we began to do is we began to take people who couldn't afford to go to that conference, just some way in order to start to pay for that money back. And because I know the book says if I don't do this, that I'm in danger of drinking. And I believe that with all my heart because I'm a person who totally believes in karma. I believe that. I believe in the spirit of the universe. And I believe that the spiritual laws never change. They are there. They never, ever change. And if I violate those spiritual laws, I'm going to pay for it in some way. I'm going to pay for that in some way if I violate that spiritual law. And so in that case, that's what we did. So if you've got some financial amends and there's no way to pay them back, then there are other ways. Find someone who needs the money. Find a way to make restitution in some way. Because it's about cleaning up, and what I owe needs to go back into the universe is kind of the way I look at it. That might sound a little woo-woo-ish, but that's how I feel. I just feel like if I owe the money, if I can't find the person or I can't, then I need to get that money that I owe, because I truly believe money's energy, and I need to get that money back into the universe. Okay, making amends. The most difficult amends that I had to make was making amends to my sons. And I had one of the things that I am so grateful for is strong sponsorship. And we've been talking about that, and we could do a whole workshop on sponsorship, because I think that that is so important. And that's somebody that cares more about me than I'm even beginning to care about myself, and trying to help me be better and have a better life. And when I got through with step 7 and made my 8-step list, Frank looked at me and he said, "You need to make amends to those boys." And I just didn't know how I was gonna do that. I didn't know what to say, because he was not mincing any words with me. He wasn't soft pedaling me in any way. He said to me, "You are a child abuser, and you are going to go make amends to your sons, and you're not going to do." Frank used to use this word all the time, and I'm hearing it more now in AA than I did 30 years ago. And that's it. You're not going to do watered down AA. And he said, "You're going to go make amends to those boys," and he said, "And you're going to tell them how sorry you are that you abuse them. You're not going to soft pedal and use words like, 'I'm so sorry I hurt you,' and all this stuff that's just really, you know, that just stuff that's not even right." And he kept telling me to pray the second part of the Serenity Prayer, courage to change the things I can. And he says, "Just keep praying for the courage." And I went and I made amends to the boys. And I told them how sorry I was and that I was a child abuser, and that I was going to spend the rest of my life trying to be the very best mom I could be. Well, Frank gave me another set of instructions. And he says, when I asked him, "Is there anything else, or is there anything you'd like to say to me?" He said, "If they tell you things like, you know, how they feel and all of that, then you don't get to say things like, 'You shouldn't feel that way because I'm sober now.'" That I was to validate every one of their feelings. And I had a standard little answer that I was supposed to say: "I am so sorry that that happened to you. And I will work this program to the best of my ability to do everything I can to be a good mom to you." And I want you to know, my sons were 14 and 16 years old, and they were angry. They were very angry. And when I asked that question, I might as well have been fired with an automatic rifle, because they had plenty to say that day. They had plenty to say. They were angry. They were hurt. They felt betrayed by me. All of the things that a little guy would feel, and especially when they're that angry. And then one I had who was just so souped up on drugs that after he got sober, he didn't even remember I did it. And so I told him after, when he was saying something like that, he didn't remember, because Russ and I were talking about it one day. And I said, "Well, Russ, if you can't remember, then James, if you can't remember, then I need to do it again." And then what was really nice is when James got sober, he came to me and he made amends to me for the kind of son he had been and the things that he had done to hurt me. And then what was probably the most beautiful thing about the amends steps is that it was right after the Minneapolis International, and we had gone to Chicago and had gone with the kids to Minneapolis, and we were sitting James and I were sitting on the front porch, and he said, "I really need to talk to you." He said, "I made amends to you back when I first got sober." He said, "But they were just amends. They were just things I just said, because that's what the book said to say." And he said, "I really didn't have any heartfelt feelings about it." But he says, "What I want to do is I want to do that again." And both of us got to do it again those years later. and then more healing had taken place. And it's amazing. I mean, I have a son who's sober in the rooms 25 years. He's 46 years old and calls me at least two or three times a week. I mean, that is just huge. And to think of the kind of mom I am, and what's the what is the just the greatest thing of all is I have five grandchildren. And here I am, a mom who abused her children, and because of doing this work and being willing to take directions from a sponsor when I couldn't see how it could possibly do any good and do it anyway, that they leave those kids with me. Last summer, I had my California girls for 2 weeks. I got to have them. Parents way far away. Great. Just keep them down there. And I got to have the girls myself. And I get to have the boys and Maddie and Chicago. And these are the benefits of going and doing these amends, the financial amends. Dave and I didn't have a house for 10 years because of that. Now, because we were willing to do the things that we're taught to do in this program, you know, we're free. We're free. I call the ninth step the freedom step. That, to me, it's the freedom step. Go make amends. And Keith Lewis used to say, it is spiritual to admit I'm wrong. It is absolutely a spiritual experience to admit I'm wrong. And it has been for me. It's so hard to get it out. And in one of the hardest places, I can tell you, I absolutely love and adore my husband. But I can guarantee you, the place that I choke it out the hardest is to him. It's so hard for me to admit I'm wrong. And this was just a really silly one that happened the other day. We have two of the cutest little Shih Tzu dogs you ever saw. And they're our kids. And I am crazy about them, but Dave is worse, if you can believe this. I mean, we talk baby talk to them and the whole thing. It's just so stupid. But anyway, we've got one that is so, he's so neurotic that he will not pee in his yard. And I said, Dave, you have, and Dave watches them way more than I do. You have to take that dog out 3 times a day out of his yard. And he says, he pees in the backyard, Polly. I said, he does not pee in the backyard. And this big, you know, you just want to do that because you just want to get out of it. You don't want to take him because it's too much trouble, da, 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 da. And the way you can tell if puppy's done that is I've never seen a dog stand on 3 legs any longer than that dog can stand. If he's, I mean, he'll just hold it forever. Well, I took him out after I stomped out of the house because I knew Dave hadn't taken him out. And he just went like that. And I'm like, peed in the backyard, I guess. And I just had to go in there. I know this is so stupid, but this is the kind of stuff that'll make me crazy and eat my lunch. It's those, you know, it's like being kicked to death with rabbit punches. That's what, you know, he was talking. It's that little silly stuff that'll kill me. And I went back in there and I said, well, you're right. He must be peeing in the backyard. So it's just stuff like that, because I've got I have angry actions. Does anybody have angry actions? Stomping angry actions. So, anyway, just make the amends, whatever they are. Just keep my side of the street clean. It's a spiritual experience to admit I'm wrong.
Any more?
Well, I have pretty basic ones. I made amends to my parents. My parents didn't know anything about alcoholism, and I'm so grateful I got to do that. My mother died of Alzheimer's, and I'm really grateful that I got to care for her and take care of her until I couldn't anymore, and to be a good daughter. I had the opportunity to be a good daughter. One of the things that I was and I'm grateful for, and I left a job being a good employee. And one of the things that happens is I think we have such a delusion with who and what we think we are. But I went to this job, and I am uneducated, but I seem to have a way of being able to work with people. And so I had this job of where I was a contractor for hospitals and physicians for certain amounts of money when you go to the doctor. And if you have an HMO, I was a person that contracted those services and the physician. And I always felt like I was so much less than the people I worked for. And I had no perception of what I did. And I'd walk into that office all the time because I worked with master's degrees and PhDs and physicians. And I felt so less than them. And I always felt like one of these days they're going to find out I don't know anything. I don't know if any of you have ever had that feeling. I'm going to go into this job and they're going to find out I don't know anything. Well, what happened was it was wonderful when I retired. I retired on a high note. I quit while I was ahead. That whole thing. And what ended up happening is my perception was so askewed that they ended up hiring two people for the job I did. Had no idea. Because my self-worth was so low that I had to work twice as hard just to stay even. And didn't even realize it. And that was just 4 years ago. So I don't get well fast. I do not get well fast. But I'm glad that I gave, because I can still hear Frank Honeycutt. If you'd go in and you'd complain to him about a job, he was in the Navy. He'd say, you know what you are supposed to do on that job? You're supposed to say, yes, sir, and give them a snappy salute. That's your job. That's all you're supposed to do. And I truly took that to heart and did exactly what he said. And it's amazing how much better I felt as an employee.
I got one.
All right.
One of the two most difficult amends I had, and I almost didn't make it because I didn't think it was work, was to my parents. Mm-hmm. And I had really hurt my parents a lot. It was so bad that my parents were forced to cut me out of their life. They wouldn't take my calls. I could call from jail, or they'd hang up on me. And they could cut me out of their life, but they couldn't cut me out of their heart. And so my mother took medication, and she saw a therapist. My dad slept 15 hours a day. And I did that to them. It was so bad. I had stolen so much from my father, he became friends with the guy who owned the pawn shop in the town for buying his own stuff back, until they became such good friends that the guy cut me off. He wouldn't buy my stuff no more. And so I get sober, and people in AA start telling me. They said to me, you got to start calling your mom. I said, doesn't work. He said, don't call collect. They wanted me to send them cards and letters. And I remember the first time I called my mom, and it wasn't collect. She answers the phone, and I say, Mom, it's Rob. And she was very, like, what do you want? Where are you? Are you in Pennsylvania? No, Mom, I'm in Nevada. She said, well, the operator didn't get on and ask me to pay for the call. I said, no, Mom, I paid for the call. She went, you paid for the call? She couldn't believe it. I had this. My ego has a sense of entitlement. Like, parents are something you use, right? So I started calling them every week, and I paid for the call, sending them cards, letters, Father's Day, Mother's Day, all that stuff. Never missed. And it wasn't well received. You know, you break someone's heart over and over and over and over again. You have someone that loves you and you somehow punish them for it. The road back out of that's not an overnight thing. And when you think of it objectively, if my parents would have instantaneously forgiven me and welcomed me back, there'd be something wrong with their mental health. I mean, really, in the light of all the years of things I did to them. When I was a year sober, after, as a result of these phone calls and letters and cards and everything, they decided to come to Las Vegas to eyeball me. And here's their attitude. Their attitude's, you know, he's probably still a bum. But we've never been to Las Vegas. It wouldn't be a complete loss. And so they get on a plane, and my mother was so cute, she gets off the plane. She looked worn out. I said, what's wrong, Mom? She said, it was hard holding that plane up. And she is so cute. I took them out to dinner with my sponsor and his wife, and I took them to my home group, and they got to see me with you. And I've never been better than when I'm with you. They got to see me with the guys that I sponsor, that I would pick on. They got to see me with the old timers that would pick on me and the guys I ran with. It's the first rule of plumbing: crap runs downhill, right? They got to see the camaraderie. They got to see my friends and the people I went to carried the meetings into the hospitals with. And they loved AA. I remember one time, they went almost every night with me to a meeting while they were in town. They're not even alcoholics. I remember one night, my mom's listening to some woman talking about getting her kids back, and my mom's sitting there, she's crying. She says to my dad, "This is great." They loved AA. Right before they left to come back to Pennsylvania, I went over to meet them at the coffee shop of the hotel they were staying at, the Stardust. And I had on a piece of paper the best figuring I could come up with of all the money I owed my father, and it was a lot. And I'm talking about when you have warrants or fines, and he loans you the money so you don't go to jail, and when you don't have the rent money, and he loans you the money so you're not going to be out in the streets, and on and on. And you take all those years of that, it added up. It added up so much that the best I could do, the best plan of repayment I could come up with, it was going to take me 12 and a half years to pay my father back. But they told me in AA, you didn't sell your integrity all at once. You sold it a nickel and a dime at a time. You're going to buy it back a nickel and a dime at a time. So I went to my dad and I told him what my plan was. I was going to send him so much a month over a period of 12 and a half years. And he just smiles at me, and my mom and him look at each other. And he says to me, he says, "Rob," he says, "we don't want you to pay the money back. That we're just happy what you're doing. We don't understand this AA, but we just want you to keep going. And if you just keep going to AA and stay sober, you don't forget about the money. You don't owe us nothing." Well, I just hit the recovery lottery, man. I just got out of 12 and a half years of payments. I am excited. I'm starting to think, man, this amends is good. I like this. I'm on my way over to my sponsor's office to tell him the good news, and on the way over there, I'm thinking about other people I owe money to. I wonder if I get them to see the light. And I get to my sponsor's office, and I go in, I tell him the great news. My dad says I didn't pay him. And my sponsor says, "It doesn't matter what your dad says. That is your debt. You must find a way to pay him. This is your integrity." And I'll tell you, if there's ever a time I wanted to change sponsors, it was right about then. And I said to him, I said, "What am I going to do? If I send him a little check every month, they're pretty sound financially. He's not going to cash it." And he says to me, he says, "I don't know, but I believe if you're willing, a way will be shown." Didn't think much of it. Found right after that, I'm at work one day, and I'm working as a cashier in a store running a register. This is the late 70s. My father had one hobby that bordered on an obsession. He collected silver coins and silver certificates and gold certificates and wore nickels and wheat pennies. He just would sit at the kitchen table for hours with those books and all those coins and putting them in boxes and bags and categories and all that stuff. He loved that stuff. And I'm working at a cash register. And in the late 70s, every single day, silver coins are coming through that register. Silver certificates, gold certificates, war nickels, wheat pennies. And I thought, maybe if I talked to my boss, he'd let me buy some of this stuff out of the register. Never imagining that I'm going to save up, for God's sakes, everything I owe my dad in these coins. That'd be impossible. But I thought maybe I could save some of it and give it to my father maybe one year as a Christmas present or something. You know, I could make a dent in the debt. And a funny thing happened. From the minute I started doing that, I started getting lucky. Funny stuff started happening. I started getting raises and bonuses. There was a guy in AA who had a moving business. He used to pay me $100 cash just for a couple hours work, helping him move furniture. And what would have, oddly enough, I had figured the best I could do was make payments for 12 and a half years. At about 4 years, I had saved up at face value everything I owed my father. And I gave it to him, and I gave it to him knowing he'd keep it. He could no longer give that stuff back than a crack addict give back an eight ball. I mean, It lit him up, man. It lit. Oh, he had something. Now he had something to play with for weeks, man. It was. Oh, it lit him up. And I want you to know something. I had made verbal amends to my father. I had restored a lot of that. And my father loved me. But I'll tell you something. After I paid him that, gave him those coins and paid him back that money, he respected me. Mm-hmm. He never respected me. He loved me. There was no doubt. But it's Bob. It's Bob. You know Bob. It's Bob. It's Bob. It's Bob. I was the erring boy, you know. It's Bob. But I became a man in my father's eyes when I paid him back that money. Mm-hmm. And he died that next year. And he died that next year, and I was able to get on an airplane and fly back to Pennsylvania and be there for my mother and be there for my sister. And I was able to bury my father, and there was no ghosts. I know about ghosts. When my grandfather died, there was ghosts of all the regrets and the things I did to hurt him and the things I never said to him that I should have said to him and the things I never thanked him for and on and on and on. My father died. There was no ghosts. He died knowing that I knew he loved me and knowing that I loved him. We were even. We were one with. And my father's spirit lives within me still. When my daughter was born, I felt him in that delivery room. When I sold my business and I got the first seven-figure check, I could hear his voice saying, "Rob, you done good. You done good." Often in my sobriety, things will happen. And this sounds crazy, I even talk to his spirit sometimes. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that. I think the Orientals in their culture and in their spiritual view of the universe believe in a connectedness between us and our relatives and our ancestors. The Hindus believe that we are all one. Einstein said the great illusion of mankind was that there's more than one of us here. When I make amends to you, I am healing myself because I am you. I can't escape that. And when I hurt you, invariably, I will sabotage my life somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Invariably, you can't, and it's my doing. Unconscious, it's not conscious. I don't say, I'm going to ruin my life. But you can bet, if you go run, you go like a tornado through people's lives and you hurt a lot of people. I know a guy now that's sober 20 years and he has a telemarketing business and he has scammed a lot of people and he's made a lot of money and he's broke all the time. Because you can't hold on to something. That's the kind of money he doesn't spend. He got it from little old ladies. Mm-hmm. He got it from people that didn't know any better. He got it from marks, basically. And he's always broke. Always looking for the next big deal. Spiritual growth and material growth, cause and effect. Incremental. I've watched guys over the years, and I'll say this and we'll shut it down. I've watched guys over the years go for the big deals. The ego wants that. The big deals want to be the big shot. You watch them over a course of 10 or 15 years, and you watch the guy who just wants to go to work and do the right thing. The guy who just wants to make amends. The guy who just wants to be of service. And the guy that's making the big deal guy, he's going like this and like this, like this, his financial situation. 15 years later, he still has nothing, looking for the big deal. The other guy is just going to work every day. Now he owns a house and he bought a car and he's putting his kids through school and he has a great life. Because he puts spiritual principles first. The ego can't stand living like that because there's not enough immediate gratification. But spiritual growth is not immediate. It's slow. And all good things that come to us seem to come slowly. Anything else?
No, I think I'm done. I just, a lot of times I could sit here and talk about a lot of the amends that I've had the opportunity to watch the women I sponsor make, and that they're incredible. And that's another thing about what's so beautiful about sponsoring people is I get a spiritual experience just listening and watching them do the amends. It's amazing to watch. It's magical because of how it works. It's the freedom step. It's the thing, in my opinion, that sets us free.
Tell one more story?
Okay. I still sponsor this woman, and she lived in Southern California, and she's adopted. And her parents had four boys, and they desperately wanted a little girl. So they adopted this little girl. But her mother wanted a really feminine, prissy, little doll-playing little girl. Well, Lisa is not that. She's a basketball player, she's a soccer player, and she was the top-of-the-line tomboy. And they just didn't really, I mean, it was already setting up that they, you know, they just kind of didn't like what they bought. And it's terrible, but it was just... It started that way, and then Lisa ends up being an alcoholic. And she goes into treatment the first time when she's 16 years old. And she gets sober, and she stays sober for a while, and then she relapses. And now she's 19 years old, and her parents, she goes back into treatment at 19 years old, another treatment center. She goes back into treatment, and while she's in treatment, her parents move and leave town, and she has no idea where they went. None. I mean, it is a story of such heartbreak, and she had no idea where they went. So she stays sober for a few more years, and she gets sober again at 23. And I start working with Lisa, and Lisa's got all kinds of problems. You talk about the mental problems we were talking about, and she'd go to this psychiatrist and that psychiatrist, and she'd been in treatment enough times that they saw all this stuff that was wrong with her, and how could, you know, she had abandonment issues out the yin-yang and all of that stuff. And it was just an absolutely tragic thing. And Lisa stayed sober 7 years, and she really got involved. She got involved with a bunch of people that were down in the South Bay and that were really working the steps, and she was really involved. But there was just this thing about her parents. Then she found her parents, and they were in Boulder, Colorado, and they had moved there, and all her brothers were there too. The parents and the brothers, and nobody had told Lisa. And so Lisa came up to me. So Lisa relapsed again. Now, in this length of time that I've been working with Lisa, she continues to relapse. And so she's off to treatment again. Her job now is sending her to treatment. And, you know, we talk about this thing of when you work with somebody and when you don't. And I looked at Lisa and I told her, I said, I love you with all my heart. And maybe I love you too much. Maybe I love you like a daughter. Maybe I just love you too much. But if you can't stay sober this time, then I think that you need to get another sponsor. That doesn't mean I'm going to be out of your life, but I think you need to get another sponsor. And she came back from treatment, and she says, I don't want another sponsor, but I'll do anything you tell me to do. And so we did another fifth step. She did a fourth and another fifth. And I said, well, let me just tell you what I think you're going to have to do in order to get free from this feeling you and this resentment and this abandonment you have from your parents. And I said, I think you need to start writing them, just send them a card. I said, Mother's Day was 2 weeks away. I said, get your mother a card and send it to her. She said, well, I can't do that. They left me. They don't want to hear from me. I said, maybe they don't. Why don't you just try? why don't you just try? And she did that for 4 years. Much, I don't know what it is with four, but she did that for 4 years. And in 4 years, they got back in touch with her. And I just talked to her today on the phone. And, well, I didn't talk to her. I talked to her husband. And what happened was, is Lisa wanted so desperately to have a family, get married, and have a child. And none of that was happening. Every relationship she got into was a disaster. But after having correspondence for about 2 years with her family, going back and seeing them and making these amends, and being the very best daughter she could be, she met a man. And, you know, it's kind of like you and your really good job and the business and all that. I mean, she met a really rich man and a really nice man. I mean, nice and rich. And it was just fabulous. And Lisa wanted to have a child really bad, but she was 38 years old now. She's 38 now. And anyway, her and Frank got married, and now she has Zoe. And it's an amazing story of amends. And there is no way that you could ever convince Lisa that her life is a direct byproduct of her making amends to parents who she absolutely knew did not love her and never wanted to hear from her. And the good news is her mother ended up dying of cancer as shortly after she had Zoe. And what happened was, is her mother got to see Zoe and her little baby before she died. I mean, God has a way of just putting all the pieces of the puzzle together just so magically. And none of this stuff, you just, you know, it's like, I think Bob said it, if I remember right, it's like God has the blueprint. And if we'll just, and you know, and I think God gives us these little nudges. You know, you feel that, I owe that money. Oh, this is why the business isn't working. And you get those little nudges. And if we answer those nudges and we listen to the small little voice within and we follow that direction, magical things are going to happen. And when I told her to do those amends, I just did that because I believe that's what we have to do. I had no idea anything would even happen. But what we do is that's what a sponsor did for me, and that's what I do for the people I sponsor, for the women I sponsor. Just go make amends whether you think it's going to work or not.
Want to call it a night?
I'm done.
See you in the morning at 9 a.m.
All right.